This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. It sounds like an Orwellian nightmare. The government is expanding its powers beyond its authority to keep tabs on its citizens with a secret program. One man comes forth to reveal the program, spilling those secrets. He's been branded as a traitor by some, a hero by others. The entire issue of national security versus protection of your privacy gets distorted by this funhouse mirrors that we have of partisan politics. We're going to talk about what's going on with this NSA domestic spying program, as some call it. Some say it's much to do about nothing. New polls have conflicting reads on what the American people are comfortable with. We invite you to join the conversation. Give us a call at 614-8980. You could also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. Go to the comments section on our website at tpr.org. And currently, right now, we do have Ron Silvert. He's a law professor and director of the Advanced International Affairs Program at Texas A&M University. Later on, we'll have be joined by Julian Sanchez of the Cato Institute to give a different side of the argument. But Ron, welcome to The Source.
To be here.
So you do have the argument that this is much to do about nothing, right?
Well, to an extent. I mean, what concerned me about the initial media reports were that they indicated, one, that we were, by we, I mean the government, was monitoring content of phone calls and content of emails of U.S. citizens, and they also seemed to indicate that this was we were acting illegally. But the real truth of the matter is that the NSA program, when it relates to U.S. citizens, was only obtaining and was very limited to the information, specifically the numbers of phones called and also the email addresses. And that this is legal, and it's legal because the Supreme Court in the 1970s and 80s had two cases where they say whatever you share with a third party, for example, you share with phone company, ISP, and the rest, that you have a lesser expectation of privacy in that information. That's why the ISPs always get those pop-ups on your computer, because they're sharing your information. You don't have the same expectation of privacy in who you email. And the Congress followed up with two laws, one the Electronic Communication Privacy Act related to phones, and then later the Patriot Act related to emails, and said that the government, if it had a legitimate intelligence purpose and legitimate criminal purpose, could do this, obtain these numbers as long as they had a court order showing to the judge that it was legitimate intelligence purpose. And that's what this is all about, and that's what happened. You know, I understand people are never comfortable with this, and I can understand that, but it's to indicate that it's content or to indicate that it's illegal, that's not true. And one other aspect before I take your question is that there is a separate program called PRISM, but that relates to communications of foreign nationals who are speaking from overseas. Obviously, if you're communicating from Pakistan, Indonesia, it goes to the U.S., we can pick up that content, but our Constitution does not apply to those foreign nationals. So Supreme Court held that in 1990, so that's not an issue either.
Now, Professor Sievert, the Fourth Amendment, that is what people are talking about now, and we're seeing this online movement, Restore the Fourth. So let me just read what that says. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, and papers and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall be issued but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be searched, to be seized. Now, that seems, and so from you're saying that this online monitoring, a gathering of megadata is not a violation of the Fourth, and also the Supreme Court supports that.
Well, yes, the Supreme Court in the case called Smith v. Maryland in 1978, another case called Miller, probably 1982, I think it was, said that these are not searches like you're talking about under the Fourth Amendment, because to be a search, you have to have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And when you share something with a third party, you do not have the same reasonable expectation of privacy.
But that's a weird thing, that reasonable expectation of privacy, though. I want to try to get to that issue. I mean, so if I want to talk to someone privately, I have to be in a room with them face to face. That's the only way I can have a private conversation with someone.
No, because your phone calls and the content of your phone calls and the content of your emails, just like the content of that conversation, you do have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And let me explain, to obtain that content, the government has to, and I did this many years as a DOJ prosecutor, to obtain that content, you have to go to a federal judge and have a 60-page or more affidavit that shows probable cause that an individual is either committing a criminal act or is an agent of a foreign power. That's what you need to get content. That's complying with the Fourth Amendment, because that is a search and that is a seizure. And therefore, you do have to meet probable cause to get that content. Totally different deal from just numbers. Now, don't get me wrong. I understand that you can, by just looking at numbers, you can pick up information as well. But it's still not the same thing as the content of the phone call and the content of the email. Totally different issue.
Now, people say, I have nothing to hide. They're not worried about that. I mean, are you comfortable with that attitude? I mean, don't you feel that people should be, you know, at least uncomfortable with the way things are going?
Yeah, I understand why. I have noticed, and I've actually been talking in my classes about this for the last year or two, I have noticed in some of the court opinions that this third-party doctrine, which says that you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in what you share with the ISP and what you share with the phone company, and that doctrine has been basically lost for 40 years or so, I have noticed and picked up in the courts that people are starting to be a little uncomfortable with that. Justice Sotomayor, in a case called Jones about a year ago, raised this question, she didn't have to decide it because it wasn't relevant for the case. But she did raise this question. Rand Paul raised this question the other day, too. And even though he understood about the Miller case and the Smith case, and he understood what the Supreme Court had said. So I can understand people starting to get a little uncomfortable with it. It would probably take me too long to explain how changing the law would affect law enforcement and intelligence, but I can tell you that if we did do away with the third-party doctrine, it would very much adversely affect law enforcement and intelligence, but it would probably take me 30 minutes to explain that. But anyway, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, and we absolutely do not have 30 minutes. As a matter of fact, we have no time at all because we've used up the amount of time we were able to schedule with you. Ron Sievert, he's a law professor at Texas A&M University. He says yes, sir.
Can I say one more thing before I
leave? 10 seconds.
Okay. These things can always be abused, and when someone abuses it, then you go after the person, the abuser. You don't eliminate the authority. You don't eliminate the intelligence operation.
Got it. We're out of time. We'll be right back after this message. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the recent revelations about the NSA, PRISM, and some spying programs, snooping programs on Americans, keeping metadata about phone calls and emails sent. And earlier we heard from the Texas A&M law professor Ron Sievert, who says that this is not a violation of the Fourth Amendment, and this is not something that we really should be that worried about. But let's go ahead and change things up a little bit. Julian Sanchez joins us. He's from the Cato Institute, and he has a different take on things. Is that right, Julian? Welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me. So it's certainly true that under the current Supreme Court doctrine, records like these, even though they're incredibly sensitive, and more so when aggregated and you apply sophisticated data analytics to them, the thing is, the decision that they're all referring to, the 79 Smith v. Maryland, first of all, you just know it's a decision that, you know, an overwhelming majority of Fourth Amendment scholars believe was wrong at the time, incoherent, frankly, at the time. And as I think we can see now, is that as technology has changed so that more and more information about us is held by third parties, I mean, really threatens to render the Fourth Amendment irrelevant to the way we actually live in practice. And, you know, no need to get into the sort of weeds on the problems with that original decision, but it basically weaves together a couple of different strands of precedent, one that really had to do with undercover informants, meaning if you tell someone something, you can't expect that they won't volunteer that information to the police, and another involving business records that were actually tax documents that were sort of inherently supposed to be submitted to the government. And so they kind of extended from that to say, anytime you hand a record over to a third party, you have lost your expectation of privacy, which is...
Right. That basically means we have no privacy, because everything we do nowadays, there's another party involved. If your iTunes account or what have you, it's someone else. The data passes through another body.
And some people say, oh, well, I just understand we have no privacy. And it's just not true. That's not how we live. People use the internet to search for sensitive information about medical conditions or alcohol or drug problems. They use it to look at porn. A lot of people, there are a lot of sites out there. I don't think people are going to those sites thinking, well, of course, it's now public information, exactly what I'm looking at. People have an expectation of privacy in their internet communications, in their email, even in the fact that they're calling a suicide hotline or a divorce lawyer. So as just a description about what people's expectations are, unless you think everyone is unreasonable in their practice, that just doesn't hold up.
Right. So let's talk about I want to talk about how this information is being used, could be used or has been used in the past. I mean, the government has done some things in the past which we now find this is a crazy violation, like the internment of our Japanese Americans during World War II, and including some German Americans.
Yeah, and certainly including, maybe more directly relevant, the abuses of surveillance power during the 50s and 60s especially, stretching back even further than that under presidents of both parties, that were uncovered often years, if not decades after the fact, in the 1970s by a committee led by Senator Frank Church. And we discovered a really stunning array of abuses that involved using spying power, not to watch terrorists and criminals, but to spy on activists, labor leaders, civil rights leaders like Martin Luther King, who they effectively tried to force to kill himself.
And there is evidence that that power was abused and used during the Occupy Wall Street movement.
There's some that they may also have been targeted. That would be in line with what we know tends to happen when you have secret authorities, people making decisions in secret, using spying power and not being especially accountable about it. So that certainly wouldn't be surprising. In a way, what your previous guest said is I think the opposite of the truth. It's not that, well, sometimes there are abuses, and so you figure out who the bad people are and you get rid of them. The problem is that there are certain kinds of architectures of power that are inherently subject to abuse, and that what you need to do is get rid of the architecture, because the bad people will gravitate to those architectures. That's why we have a Bill of Rights. We don't say, well, we just need to make sure that people who would censor good speech don't get into power. We say the power to censor speech is dangerous, and that power should be strictly, strictly limited.
Now, we recently heard in testimony, I think it was yesterday, that Congress was told that dozens of terror plots were foiled by use of these surveillance instruments.
Yeah, at this point, you'll have to forgive me if I don't take those claims at face value. We heard for years that the warrantless wiretap program established by President Bush was absolutely vital in saving lives. And then when the Inspector General finally looked at it in 2009 and put out a report that didn't get quite as much attention, it concluded essentially this had not been a super useful tool, and they couldn't really find any cases where this program had been essential to a success. What they found was that it mostly generated a lot of false leads that sent FBI agents on wild goose chases when they could have been working on something more useful to national security. We heard exactly the same thing about fusion centers. These were these information-sharing hubs. We were told they were the centerpiece of our counterterrorism strategy. They were a vital and proven tool. And then finally, the Senate conducts a long investigation and finds that they have never produced a shred of useful, actionable intelligence. So now we're hearing these have foiled dozens of terror attacks. Maybe that means that in a lot of cases where previously they had a suspect and they had reasonable suspicion and they would have gone to get a court order for that person's phone records, Well, now they already had the phone records, so I suppose they could say, yes, we used the phone records in that case because we already had them. Well, it doesn't mean you needed them to solve that particular plot. I find it, by the way, a little bit suspicious, right? They were told, you know, this is all information that absolutely must be hidden from the American people. It's information about what their own government is doing, but the American people can't know it because it would endanger national security for the American people to know until the moment at which it becomes politically useful to these agencies to disclose that information. And now suddenly it is not endanger national security for us to know what they've been doing.
Right. And I also want to get back
exactly
to
exactly as much as they wish to tell us.
So you cast doubt on the claim that dozens of terror plots were foiled through this program. And I want to get to James Clapper, who is a director of national intelligence. And he was in open congressional hearing on March 12th, was asked directly by Senator Ron Wyden. He asked Clapper, does the NSA collect any type of data on at all on millions of or hundreds of millions of Americans? And Clapper replied, no, sir, not willingly. And now we all know that was a complete lie. He lied right in the congressional hearing. So obviously the folks at the NSA have no compulsion. They will lie if they have to do what they have to do.
I mean, it's incredible to me that there may not be consequences to Clapper for this, because if you can lie directly to Congress in a public hearing, unambiguously to Congress, about whether these secret agencies are in fact collecting information on millions of Americans, then you're play acting at democracy. You have the buildings and the flags, but not the essence of it. Because this is the one check. These agencies that we imbue in our name with massive powers to act in ways that we're not informed about. The only real check and accountability here is what they're able to say to Congress, and even that is pretty limited because Congress doesn't get pressure from us unless we have some idea what's going on. So if they're allowed to give these false assurances in public hearings, the last shred of accountability is removed. And we know what happens when secret intelligence agencies are not held accountable pretty rigorously, and it looks pretty ugly.
And certainly a loss of credibility from the NSA. The number to call is 614-8980. If you want to get a quick call in, ask a question, make a point, 614-8980. Now, what is partisan politics? I don't know, James, Julian, if you can address that, but it's just really hard to figure out. You know, there are people who are very liberal, who are very upset about this, and then people who are very, and conservative, who are going along with it, and vice versa, because of loyalties.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. If you look at polls, I don't know how reliable polls are on an issue like these. Are complex sort of issues, and the wording matters a great deal to what people say. But it does look like, under George Bush, Republicans were totally comfortable with this sort of thing. Democrats were very much opposed to it. Republicans have gotten a lot less comfortable with it. Democrats have gotten a lot more comfortable with it. I actually just watched on YouTube a clip of Sean Hannity talking about NSA surveillance before and now recently, and he used to.
Or you could do the same thing with Chris Matthews. Yeah. It would be the same thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, this is on both sides, right?
So let me just ask you, though. So the Democrats, some are saying this is different than Bush because Barack Obama has more judicial oversight. Does that make a difference?
It is true that Bush just sort of unilaterally decided to ignore FISA. And so now what we have is not the metadata program. The metadata program is Section 215. And that, seems to have been going on under both presidents basically unchanged. There's a different kind of authority under the FISA Amendments Act that's sort of the follow-up to the warrantless wiretap program. And so that passed in 2008. And so it does mean that instead of, again, just sort of unilaterally ignoring the law, there is a statute and there is some judicial authorization, but it's a very weak kind of oversight. This is not the individualized probable cause warrants contemplated by the Fourth Amendment. It is judges approving very broad authorizations to target sort of entire groups, and all they really approve are targeting procedures that are designed to ensure you're mostly collecting foreign communications. But the actual kind of decisions about, all right, what email accounts and what phone lines are we going to vacuum up, are still not made by a judge. That's still made by, you know, analysts sitting at a terminal without anyone really.
Let me ask you something.
Shoulder.
When someone says, "I'm not worried about this because I've got nothing to hide," are they just, you know, in walking around with the blinders on, or are they cool?
Well, look, everyone has something to hide. I mean, everyone has a thing that they don't want strangers poking into about their lives. But your life must be very boring. But even if you don't, that is not really the point. I mean, it's like sort of like saying, "Well, I'm not black. Why do I care about racism?" You know, there are, one, maybe you care about other people, but also there are effects on society as a whole from having certain constraints on power. So even if you have very mainstream political and religious views, living in a democracy, being subject to the laws democracy produces, means you have an interest in letting criticism and protest and different views be aired, because otherwise the democratic process doesn't work. And the same way, I think, surveillance power, because we know it tends to concentrate power in the people who run the cameras, can be dangerous whether or not you're the one spied on. You know, if they had succeeded in derailing Martin Luther King's civil rights movement, a lot of people, beyond the particular ones that were spied on, would have been worse off for it. We're all affected when surveillance is abused, as we know it historically has been, for political purposes.
Right, and the government does believe that you do have something to hide, and so they're going to keep an eye on you. Anyway, Jillian Sanchez from the Cato Institute, thank you so much talking about the NSA program. Some people call it a domestic spying program. This is The Source on KSTX. We're going to continue. We're going to be talking about the San Antonio Symphony, the future of the symphony, when we come back from this news break.